So what I want to start with is just reading the whole chapter. That way, if I take long enough, I won't have to answer the hard questions this week. Howdy, Max. Okay. Daniel chapter 7, starting in verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then, as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast. Terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These 4 great beasts are 4 kings who shall rise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the 4th beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which 3 of them fell. The horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things, and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand. And for a time, times, and half a time, but the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Okay. Now, last week, I believe we did section 2. Number 2 in on page 61, the questions under his second division, the Ancient of Days, Judges, the Beasts. So, did we finish that section? Nobody, I think we finished that section. And so, if that be the case, do you have something? Were you going to make a comment? Oh, okay. Good. Well, no, he's sitting like this. And so I thought he was getting ready. But in oh, we haven't gone into that section. Oh, what I said was this, that I would switch those two questions, the order of those two questions. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So, no questions about any of the stuff under section 2. Except for Seth. He doesn't count because he wasn't here last week. He would ask everything. Yes. Okay. The third section, the coming of the Son of Man. And the writer writes, Daniel sees a figure riding on the clouds of heaven in verse 13. What does that suggest about the nature or status of this figure? Who else in the Bible rides on the clouds of heaven? And so what I said is I would switch those questions, because the answer to the second question enables us to answer the first question. Okay? So the issue here is, he's saying in verse 13, this Son of Man is introduced as one who is riding on the clouds of heaven. And he's asking, well, what does that say about that, about the Son of Man, that he's riding on the clouds of heaven? So to me, naturally, the first thing to do is to look at that phrase in the Old Testament, how it's used. And that's what he directs us to do in that second question. Yeah, maybe it should say, hint, who else rides on the clouds of heaven? Yes, very good. Maybe he just left out the word hint. Well, somebody want to read Psalm 104:3, and then someone else Isaiah 19:1? Pardon? Yeah, why don't you read the first three verses of Psalm 104? Stand and blast it out. And I add verses 1 and 2 just so you can pick up the context. Notice who it's talking about. First three verses. But that was good too. Thanks, Nick. Okay, in verse 3, who is riding on the clouds? Hint, he was described in the first two verses. Yeah. God, the majestic, splendid God is the one who is riding on the clouds. Psalm 19:1. Yes, I'm sorry. Isaiah 19:1. Nick and I make a good team. Very good. Thank you. Again, who's riding on the clouds? The Lord. The Lord is riding on clouds. So I think this phrase is used like 8 or 9 times in the Old Testament. And every other instance of its use, it's very clearly referring to God or Yahweh riding on the clouds. So what then the other question, what does that suggest about the nature or status of this figure? Yeah, it might be God. If this does not strongly suggest or imply the deity of the Son of Man, it would be the only instance in the Old Testament that this phrase isn't used of God. And that's just not the way you, that's not the way you make interpretive decisions. If you've got 8 uses and 7 of them is clearly God, you wouldn't come to this one and say, oh, well, it doesn't say Lord, so it's not God. No, you would say, this is referring to God overseeing his creation. He is above the heavens. He makes it his chariot. So it would actually be attributing a divine activity, a divine prerogative to the Son of Man. And so the logical thing is, that means the Son of Man is also divine. The Son of Man is also God. You see how that works? Critical scholars will say that that's not attributing deity to the Son of Man. But it's not the way hermeneutics works. The science of interpretation, that's not the way the practice of interpretation works. Does that make sense? So it's more than just a hint. This is actually attributing a divine activity or prerogative to the Son of Man. And that's what we learn from all those other references, even the other five or six that we didn't read. This is an activity or prerogative of God, of Yahweh. Notice in, let's see, I don't want to steal. We'll get into that at the top of page 62. So, Joe, did your question get answered? Oh, okay. Yes. Well, then let's get there. The author writes this. He says, although this figure is clearly in some sense divine, Daniel sees that he is like a son of man. How might this shed light on Jesus' favorite self-designation, Son of Man? Now, was your question just, what's the answer? Or was... Worded? Right. I think it's simple, but I've been studying this stuff for a few decades. Right, yeah. Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Why would, given what this picture says about Jesus or says about the Son of Man, why would Jesus choose this as his favorite self-designation? Why would Jesus like to use this about himself? That's part of it. What other part does it show? His humanity. Yeah, so it pictures both his humanity and his deity. You look like you were getting ready to... Yes. So, it pictures both his human nature and divine nature, what we call in theology the hypostatic union, the God-man, one person with two natures, human and divine, okay? It pictures him that way. But why would... that's one reason. That's one of my reasons. But... why would Jesus in his life on earth be particularly drawn to that? designation. That guy didn't answer that, but I went beyond his question and commented on that. Well, let me tell you what I wrote. I said it pictures the union of his human nature and divine nature. So it pictures the God-man, but emphasizes his humanity, right? Son of man riding on the clouds of heaven. So it comes right out and calls him Son of Man. But it just attributes the divine activity to him. Doesn't come out. It's not like it says Son of God. It says Son of Man. And attributes. So even though it's picturing both his human nature and his divine nature, it's emphasizing his humanity. And I'm taking the context. What does the Son of Man do in this Daniel 7 here? Yes, he receives the kingdom. And what happened? The Ancient of Days, the thrones were set up. He sat. So you... Here's an interesting thing. Have you noticed that there's a sandwich here? The beast is sandwiched in between the Father and the Son. It goes into great description about the Father, doesn't it? We talked about that last week. Pardon? Verses 9 through 14. Verses 9 and 10, we have the Father. Verses 11 and 12, we have the fourth beast. We have the little horn. And then in verses 13 and 14, we have the Son, right? And I think it's interesting that... He goes into, notice the description of the Father, then the description of the Son. Great descriptions of them, extended descriptions of them. And then notice in verses 11 and 12, the impact. Just read that. I then looked after the Father set up court, and he sat in judgments, and the books were open. Then it says, very in short fashion, I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. As I looked, the beast was killed, its body was destroyed, it was given over to be burned with fire. And then he talks about the rest of the beast. Notice how quickly that little horn, despite the fact he was wearing out the saints, despite that he was... speaking arrogant, defiant words, even as the Father was setting up court and all that, despite his power and terror on earth and him wearing out the saints of the Most High, in verse 11, he is dispatched like that. He's doing all of this activity. Father sets up the thrones, sits in judgment, the books are open, then boom, just like that in a verse, the beast is dispatched. And then you have this, you have this much greater description of the Son of Man coming and receiving the kingdom, and his kingdom will be forever and ever and ever. And so you have the beast and his destruction sandwiched in between the description of the Ancient of Days and the description of the Son of Man. And so the impression is they kind of squeeze him and he is dispatched like that. Just read the descriptions in chapters earlier in chapters, or maybe even later, but earlier and later in chapter 7 of what the horn and that fourth beast did. And then we'll see it again. We'll see it, you can also see it in Revelation 13 through 18, you can see it, but particular 13 through, I don't know, 13, 14, 16, I think, where he talks in detail of how the beast wears out the saints and all of that. And so it's an incredible picture here of the Father and the Son, and sandwiched in between them is the horn, the beast, and he's dispatched like that, just like the Father and Son are squeezing him out of the picture. I don't know if that hit any of you like that as you read through that and studied it. So here's what I added, Joe. I said that this picture of the Son of Man, it pictures the God-man, his human and divine nature, but it's emphasizing his humanity and his saving work. Think about this. Why did the eternal Son come? Why did the Father send him? What was his main work that the Father sent him for? By doing what? Yeah. Dying on the cross, rising again, setting up his kingdom, defeating all of God's enemies. Right? But what have we been learning in our catechism the last three weeks? He had to be like his brethren. He has to be truly God and truly man. Now, and this morning we learned why he had to be truly man. In order to obey the law perfectly and to pay the penalty for sins. Next week we'll talk about the catechism question. We'll cover why he had to be truly God. But he's always been God, right? He's the eternal Son. He is a divine person who, in the incarnation, took a human nature to himself. And why did he take that human nature to himself? For the saving work that God sent him to do. And he keeps that human nature for all eternity. You know, that's amazing. He took a human nature into the depths of the Trinity. That's just mind-boggling. So we're like him. We're junior brothers to him. So what I think that's probably why it was his favorite designation, because not only did it picture that he is the God-man, that he's both God and man, but it emphasized his humanity and his saving work. He came as the Son of Man to defeat God's enemies and to rescue God's people and to set up his kingdom. Let me just throw some verses at you. I wish that guy would have spent a little bit more time. He does spend, I think, some more time on it, maybe. In the gospel glimpses, but maybe not. I wish we would have spent just a little bit more time on it, because to me it's just so rich. Listen to Hebrews. First, I'm going to read a couple of passages in Hebrews and then one in Matthew 26. Hebrews chapter 2, 14 through 18. This has long been one of my favorite passages. And by the way, our reading to begin the service has been out of Hebrews chapter 2 the last couple of 2 or 3 weeks. And we just went over this passage this morning, read it this morning. But I want to show you something in this passage, verses 14 through 18. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things. For what purpose? Why did he take on a human nature? That through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. And he doesn't mean just the physical offspring of Abraham. He's talking about the spiritual offspring of Abraham. People who are people of faith. He is the father of all believers, Abraham is. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. What's propitiation refer to? Remember Wes mentioned it this morning? Satisfying God's anger on our sin. To make propitiation for the sins of the people, or you can say to satisfy God's anger on the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he's able to help those who are being tempted. Now, I want to point out verse 16. It's really interesting. The way it's translated, it says, for surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. That word that's translated helps is not the normal word for helps. It's epilumbano. It's seize, grab hold of. What he's saying here is that Christ, the eternal Son, did not seize or laid hold of angels. He seized and laid hold of the seed of Abraham. That entails the incarnation. He laid a hold of the seed of man in order to deliver God's people, the seed of Abraham. I love that picture. Shoving aside angels, grabbing a hold of men. That's what verse 16 pictures. Now think about that. Think about that. This is the eternal Son that did this. So he entered Mary's womb and took that human nature that was conceived to himself. Okay? That's him seizing hold of the seed of Abraham. Why did he do it? Through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. To defeat Satan and deliver God's people. That's why he did this. So now picture Jesus walking around. Picture Jesus growing up as a lad, reading these things in the Old Testament, knowing who he is. And then when he starts his public ministry, to me, it's not surprising that this designation, Son of Man, which emphasizes his humanity without doing away with his deity, becomes his favorite designation, because that is what he did. He came into Mary's womb to latch, to lay hold of the seed of Abraham for the joy that was set before him, Hebrews chapter 12, that he may have many brothers and sisters. I can just see how that would be Jesus' favorite self-designation, because of its emphasizing his humanity, which he took to himself for the task of his saving work. And then I'll let you read Hebrews 9:26 on your 26b through 28 on your own. Well, we're in Hebrews, we might as well read it. Hebrews 9:26b through 28. This is more than answering your question, I hope, Joe. 26b says, "But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages," or end of the ages, that's one Greek term, that's referring to the high point of the ages. "At the high point of the ages, he appeared once for all to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. But just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes the judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who eagerly wait for him." And that is the picture we get in Daniel 7. The beast, the little horn, is wearing out those who are waiting eagerly for the Son of Man to come. And then Matthew 26. I'm sure this author doesn't mind us expanding this little question further. Matthew 26, verses 63 and 64. He says, Matthew writes, "But Jesus remained silent." This is before the high priest. And the high priest asks him, "What do you say to all these things that these guys are accusing you of?" I just lost my place. Verse 63, "But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, 'I adjure you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.'" So now, as his position of high priest in the court here, he's demanding. He's making a legal demand on Jesus to answer this question. "I adjure you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus answered. Jesus said to him, "You have said so, but I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." So when he's standing before the high priest, and the high priest makes this legal demand on him, that he tells them whether or not he is the Christ, the Messiah, he goes back and he quotes Daniel 7:13. I tell you, will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. So, you know, the work of the Son of Man to defeat God's enemy and to deliver God's people was on his mind as the eternal Son of God laid hold of the seed of Abraham in the womb of Mary and was able to stand in our place, obey the law perfectly, go to the cross, judge Satan, take on our sin in our stead, and quench God's wrath on our sin. And just right before he goes to the cross to do that, he tells the high priest, "You want to know if I'm the Messiah? From now, you just said I am. From now on," and he quotes Daniel 7:13, "from this time forward, you, the next time you see me, I will be the Son of Man coming from the throne of power," which is also depicted, right, in about the Father in verses 9 and 10, "from the throne of power, sitting on the clouds of heaven, coming on the clouds of heaven." So anyway, yes, that's just that whole extended picture there is why I think Son of Man, it's not surprising to me that that was his favorite self-designation. Yes, yes, it's the one that he used the most about himself. What's our common designations? What's the most common designation that we use of Jesus? In other words, what do we, when we're talking about him, what, who do we normally refer to him as? The Lord, Jesus, Christ, almost everything except Son of Man. And yet when Jesus talked about himself, the most common phrase he used was Son of Man. Yes. Yeah. They talk like that. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it's, I just love that whole picture. That's why I love that Hebrews passage. And I love how when at his trial, when Caiaphas demands that he tells him whether or not he's the Christ, he quotes Daniel 7:13 to him. And obviously, they didn't go, "What are we doing here?" They tore their clothes and said, "We don't need any more witnesses." They were all fake witnesses anyway. "We don't need any witnesses. He's blasphemed in our hearing." So, anyway, that's enough of that question, probably. Any other questions about that, about section 3 there? Okay, section 4. While, as we saw in chapter 2, many scholars have identified the four beasts with Babylon, Media, Persia, Greece, and Rome, the larger point to be gleaned from Daniel's vision is the ongoing conflict and chaos of earthly powers. Okay? The sea boiling, roiling, whatever, you know, the chaotic sea and the beasts coming out of the sea. He's saying that's the bigger picture is this vision of ongoing conflict and chaos of earthly powers. You've got a chaotic sea with just beast after beast coming out and killing the beast that preceded it. He says the larger point to be gleaned from Daniel's vision is the ongoing conflict and chaos of earthly powers until the Ancient of Days establishes his kingdom. How is this a hopeful message? Now, I want to back up at this point. I know I'm fiddling with this guy's questions, but I want to back up for just a minute. I want us to answer that question, but I want us to answer a question before that, and then we'll get to his question, and then I want us to answer a question after that, okay? Before we answer his question, the question I have, comparing chapter 7 and chapter 2. Remember chapter 2? Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the metal statue. Here's a question. How is chapter 7, Daniel's vision, more offensive to these Gentile world powers, these Gentile emperors? How is chapter 7 more offensive to them than chapter 2? Yeah, and yeah, I mean, exactly that. So, what's the statue made of? Metals. And the vision that, who received the vision? Nebuchadnezzar. And what metal was he? Gold, somebody said. Yeah, he was the head and he was also the gold. And so, you know, that had to stroke his ego somewhat, right? How was the kingdom of God pictured in that vision? Right, a little stone. And then it grew into a mountain. Okay? But the world, Gentile world powers were metal, gold, silver, bronze, iron. With its strength and all of that. So it's interesting that chapter 2 was given to Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 7 was given to Daniel. Chapter 2 was probably a much more palatable revelation of these four kingdoms followed by the kingdom of God than chapter 2. Daniel, I'm then chapter 7. Daniel received the vision in chapter 7, right? That's what we read. How were the beasts? I mean, how were those kingdoms? I just gave it away. How were those kingdoms pictured in the vision that Daniel got? As beasts. Yes. One devouring, and you know, they weren't necessarily pretty or noble or anything like that. They were beasts. A couple of them were parts of beasts stuck together, right? One was a bear that's laying on its side with ribs hanging out of its mouth, you know. Their character was depicted as vicious and whatnot. Nothing noble. But that was revealed to Daniel. So I think Daniel 7 would have been much more offensive to the Gentile world powers than chapter 2. The vision in chapter 2 was given to Nebuchadnezzar. It was much more diplomatic way of telling Nebuchadnezzar, your days are numbered. You're not the greatest thing on earth. And as a result of that vision, Daniel was placed in the position of power that he was, same as his three friends. Now, near the end of the Babylonian empire, Daniel gets this vision, only it's just given to him. And it's not a very pretty picture of those four world empires. Let me ask you, let's go to the author's question. Only let's put it this way. How is chapter 7 more encouraging to God's people than chapter 2? Yes. 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 And what else is brought out about his kingdom? Notice the question. How is chapter 7 more encouraging to God's people than chapter 2? And does it say anything specifically about God's people? Go on to... I'm talking about the vision. It doesn't say it in verse 14, but notice in verse 18, 17 and 18. Yes. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. Sorry about that. What does it say about the saints in chapter 2 in Nebuchadnezzar's vision? Where does it say that? Does it say anything specifically about God's people, about the saints? I know, a trick question, isn't it, Carol? It doesn't say anything about the saints. It just says that the kingdom that it's pictured as a small stone and it grows and fills the world. But it doesn't say anything specifically about the saints of the Most High, about God's people. So this vision is more encouraging to God's people because it shows exactly, it gives us a picture of the Father and the Son dispatching with the beast and setting up the eternal kingdom and giving the kingdom to the saints of the Most High to possess forever and ever and ever. So, whereas chapter 2, that vision might be more diplomatic because it's given to Nebuchadnezzar, not diplomatic in a sleazy, dishonest way, but just not all things were revealed. Is just letting Nebuchadnezzar know about what's going to happen here in the flow of history. But so he leaves out a lot of details. And so it, in that regard, it's more diplomatic. But here, when it's revealed only to Daniel, it puts the empires, the Gentile world empires, in a much uglier frame, and tells the saints of the Most High, you're going to possess the kingdom. I'm just thinking, if he would have given this to Nebuchadnezzar, you know, would Nebuchadnezzar raise his eye at the people of Israel? I got to watch these people.
So then would Daniel have identified the nation of Israel with the concept of a worldwide, you know, kingdom, or he would essentially tell that he's talking about God's people and that how they were done then?
Wasn't that the same thing that you just said? I think here's what it would be. Daniel wouldn't necessarily just limit the kingdom growing into a mountain, that kingdom. He wouldn't, if Nebuchadnezzar would have asked him questions offline about that kingdom, that he wouldn't have just tied it to the nation of Israel, because obviously throughout the prophets, the Gentiles are going to be included in this. He would have just simply tied it to Yahweh, to the God of the Jews. But here in chapter 7, we're told explicitly that these empires are beastly. They're beasts. They're ferocious. They're not good. They're going to be judged and dispatched with, and God's people, the kingdom, the Son of Man is given the kingdom, and he's going to establish it and give it to the saints to possess forever and ever and ever. That would have probably hit Nebuchadnezzar a little bit different than the vision of the image in chapter 2, right? And I can just see him raising his little eyebrows at the people of Israel. Does that make sense? Yeah. Well, I think we're going to have to finish this next week at 7 o'clock. I had too much stuff to add. But chapter 7, I'm telling you, chapter 7 is the key. On many different levels, chapter 7 is one of the keys in Daniel. And obviously, as this next question asks that we're going to wait on until next week, there's lots of parallels between Daniel 7 and the book of Revelation, particularly chapters 13 through 18. Lots of, even though his question is around Revelation 18 through 22. But there's lots of comparisons, lots of parallels between Daniel 7 and Revelation. So this is a key chapter. And so it's important that we go through it. Also, what we're going to see, and I'll bring this up when we go through 8 through 12, chapter 8 and then 10 through 12, but chapter 7, 8, and 10 through 12 were chapters that the Jews during the intertestamental period between the Old Testament and New Testament, when they underwent severe persecution, they turned to and relied on and clung to those specific chapters in the book of Daniel. They're referred to so much in the writings of Jewish scholars and Jewish writers during the time period between the Old and New Testament when they were undergoing intense persecution. So key chapter, and we will finish it next week.